Well, good morning. We're glad to have you here. I'm going to fall off the stairs to start this off. If you're not familiar or you're new to us or whatever, or you're my oldest son who said to me a little bit ago, like, oh, I didn't know it was Vision Sunday this week. I was like, thanks for paying attention, son. This is Vision Sunday. Oh, it says it on the slide. Vision Sunday 2017. So beginning back in 2009, we had our first Vision Sunday, and the idea behind it was like, it's good as we kick off the school year, as many of you are returning to school to get back into rhythms of school and life, and summertime is over, and vacation and all that stuff is over. It's probably good to kind of talk about who we are and why we're here and what we're about. And so that's what this Sunday became, and it became our kickoff Sunday. And so the question is what's vision? I grew up in a church. The pastor, my pastor, growing up, loved to quote the proverb that says, for lack of vision, the people perish. Have I heard this one? It's in the Proverbs somewhere. I could have looked it up, but I didn't. And he hammered that home. So as a staff member working for my pastor, earning my chops as a young pastor, that was driven into us. Without vision, people have no idea where they're going and they just kind of mill about. So have a vision for what you're doing and communicate that vision. And so every year, that's what I try to do in this talk. And some years we go different directions. And many years, I've spent a long time up here talking about all of our various many of our ministries. And many years, I've launched new ministries on Vision Sunday. And I wanted to say, we're not going to do any of those things this year. I'm not going to talk about ministries almost at all from here on out the rest of the morning. Instead, what's going to happen is at the very end of the service, Dustin is going to come up and talk about our ministry fair. So right now, for those of you that are slow to change, if you had plans on racing out of here after church, I'm going to ask you to change your plans and to plan on sticking around for a half hour, 40 minutes, hour, we don't care. And over in the Parkview room on the other side of the building, there will be a whole bunch of booths set up, 20-ish? Sure, let's say it 20. There's about 20 different ministries that will be set up, and we're going to encourage you to go over and ask them about their vision for their ministries. Even if you're not going to sign up for anything more, like you're like, I'm signed up for all the things I can possibly do right now, I encourage you to walk over and see the things that are happening that you may not know about in this church. And I'm going to push you to ask questions, to ask of them, like, what's your vision for the building? So our most recent leader, I asked Doug Urbanek on Wednesday to lead the building team. And so he's having a work day the next two Sundays. So ask Doug, like, what's your vision for the grounds and why you're doing a work day? And he'll tell you, and he'll first of all tell you to get rid of lots of weeds. Because it just stresses me out every morning when I drive in, all the weeds at this place. So I encourage you to go around to the ministries, ask them why they do what they do, and if they don't have good answers, maybe it'll give them good things to talk about at their next ministry team meeting. So that's also fun. So there's a lot of small visions in the church. Not that they're small, but there's a lot of visions for lots of different ministries. We have visions for what the Breakfast Club can become. We have visions for Genesis, and we have visions for the garden and all kinds of things. We have a vision that the deer would stop eating all the trees in the orchard. We have lots of different dreams and visions. But what I want to do this morning is talk about kind of the big thing. What is it that we're all after? Why? What are we about as a church 9.5 years in? If you don't know, this year in March, when you see the ministry calendar that you can pick up over at the ministry fair later, when you pick up the ministry calendar, you'll see there's a weekend in March that we've set aside that it will be our 10th anniversary weekend. And I don't know what that all means yet. There's a group tomorrow meeting during lunch to start putting together some plans for what that might look like. But we're gonna celebrate. We're gonna burn this town down. In a manner of speaking, in a very chill imago way, in our flip-flops. So 10 years in, what are we about? I was talking with our leadership team. We've been talking about this Sunday for the last 2 months as the leadership team kind of gearing up for this week, and we spent a lot of time last Wednesday night on this. And I think the thing that really resonated with me as we were talking about, well, we could talk about this and we could talk about that and we could be about this thing. The thing that resonated with me going back about 6 or 8 weeks ago is we started talking about this idea of growing up as a church. If you think of a church like your kids, there was a time 9.5 years ago Well, if you go back 10 years ago, right about this time was the first time I went out with my boss and we were on a golf course and I said, what if I planted a church in Peoria? How would you feel about that? It took me up to like the 11th hole to work up the courage to actually ask him. And he got really excited about it. So think of that as, you know, church plant in utero. Maybe I shouldn't push this analogy too much, but you get the idea, right? And then we were a baby church for a while and that was okay. And I tell people today, I feel like we're a strongly adolescent church, right? Like we're strongly in our teenage years, whatever that might mean. And so we've been starting to have conversations in our leadership team about what does it mean to grow up as a church? What does it mean to mature as a church? And, or to say it another way, how do we become a real church eventually, maybe someday? And so this morning, I want to talk about some ideas about what it means to grow up as a church. And maybe what it means to grow up as individuals in a church. And maybe give us something that we can all say, That's worth going after. That's where all the other things fit under that. And so to get there, I want you to pick up your Bibles, first of all, and turn to Ruth, chapter 1. The book of Ruth is sandwiched in between Judges and 1 Chronicles. It's on page 210, if you're using the Pew Bible. And I'll say this because I haven't said it, I think, in years. If you don't have a Bible, those pew Bibles were bought by somebody in the early days of our church and with the intention that if you don't have a Bible or you don't have one that you read, take it home. It's yours, all right? I haven't said that in a long time. I should say that. I just did say that. This is what goes on in my head all the time. All right. Once upon a time, I'm going to be reading, by the way, out of the Message, which won't exactly line up with what you're reading, but close enough, you can follow along. Once upon a time, it was back in the days when judges led Israel. There was a famine in the land. A man from Bethlehem in Judah left home to live in the country of Moab. He and his wife had two sons. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. His sons were named Mahlon and Chilion, all Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judea. They all went to the country of Moab and settled there. Elimelech died and Naomi was left, she and her two sons. The sons took Moabite wives. The name of the first was Orpah and the second Ruth. They lived there in Moab for the next 10 years, but then the two brothers, Mahlon and Chilion, died. Now the woman was left without either her young men or her husband. So you get the setup here to this story, right? Like, there's a famine. So this guy Elimelech takes his wife Naomi. They move to Moab. While they're in Moab, Elimelech dies. And luckily for Naomi in that culture, she still had men to take care of her. I know it's not appealing, but it's just the way it was, all right? So she still has men to take care of her sons. So her sons take two wives, Orpah and Ruth. And then her two sons died. So now she's a widow. And she has no men to take care of her, and so she has absolutely nothing. One day, she got herself together and her two daughters-in-law to leave the country of Moab and set out for home. She had heard that God had been pleased to visit his people and give them food. So the famine's off. And so she started out from the place she had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law with her on the road back to the land of Judah. And after a short while on the road, Naomi told her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, go home, and live with your mothers. And may God treat you as graciously as you treated your deceased husbands and me. May God give each of you a new home and a new husband." She kissed them, and they cried openly. Isn't that like just a beautiful scene? Her and her daughters-in-law, and she basically says to them, "You have been great daughters-in-law. And the best thing for you now is because I have nothing. I can't take care of you. I want you just to go home to your own mothers and you'll be taken care of." And they cry because they're all going to part. And they said, "No, we're going with you to your people." But Naomi was firm. "Go back, my dear daughters. Why would you come with me? Do you suppose I still have sons in my womb?" That's a weird thing to say, but "I have sons in my womb who can become your future husbands. Go back, dear daughters, on your way, please. I'm too old to get a husband. Well, and why, even if I said there's still hope and this very night got a man and had sons, can you imagine being satisfied to wait until they're grown? Would you wait that long to get married again? And ew." They would be like 30. And the boys would be, no, they'd be like 45 probably and 15. Ew. "No, dear daughters, this is a bitter pill for me to swallow, more bitter for me than you. God has dealt me a hard blow." Again, they cried openly and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth embraced her and held on. Naomi said, "Look, your sister-in-law is going back home to live with her own people and gods. Go with her. But Ruth said, and this is just so, I love this. Don't force me to leave you. Don't make me go home. Where you go, I go. And where you live, I'll live. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. Where you die, I'll die. And that's where I'll be buried. So help me, God. Not even death itself is going to come between us. And when Naomi saw that Ruth had her heart set on going with her, she gave in. So the two of them traveled on together to Bethlehem. How many of you have heard that story before? I'm just curious. Over half. So some of you, that's new. That's the half that grew up in Sunday school and had flannel graphs to teach it. I love the story, right? So there's so much, I'm sure, you know, as often with the Bible stories, there's the story, and then there's the story, like my friend Steve Ween says, there's the story between the lines. There's so much going on there. There's so much affection. There's so much love. There's so much growth. And there's so much about Ruth, for our purposes here this morning, being a young Moabite woman who marries a Jewish boy, to becoming this woman who makes this really incredible statement, wherever you go, your people will become my people, and your God will become my God. We see this incredible transformation in her, and she gives her life to following after Naomi. Just to spoil the ending of the book of Ruth is four chapters, and by the end we find out that Ruth is part of the bloodline of David. She's one of David's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers. And so she becomes pretty important in Israel's history. So I wanted, growing up is just hard to do. And so we read that story and it seems like, oh, that's no problem. But I mean, imagine for Ruth, that journey of growing up, of choosing to leave her homeland to change her gods. She switches out her gods and worships a new god, and all that is really hard to do. And for all of us, we've had our own journeys of growing up, and I could ask you about those journeys, and we all have our own journeys about different ways in which we grew up, or our different journeys of even now, how we're still growing up, how we're still learning to be an adult some days. And some days it's not working so well. And so this morning I want to talk about three ideas about what it might mean to grow up. I sat with our leadership team on Wednesday night and we just talked about what does it mean to grow up as a church. And I just want to talk about three things, I think, this morning that are about us growing up as a church. The first is that it nearly always takes some kind of crisis for us to mature. This story starts with Mahlon and Chilion died. And Elimelech died. And out of that crisis, we get this story. It nearly always takes some kind of crisis for us to mature, for us to grow, for us to go on a journey of becoming. I've been really looking over the last couple years for that book that says, you know what? The spiritual life is one where there's blue skies, you grow. When things are great, you're going to become so mature in all that. As you just succeed at everything, life will, you're just going to grow so much spiritually. I've not found that book. I've not even found a line in a book that gets close to that. I've not really met a person who's reported to me that that's how their life goes. In fact, if I set a mic up here this morning and said, I want you to tell me about what you're learning about yourself and how you're growing and how you've grown in your journey, I think almost every single one of us would get up here and tell a story about there was that time I lost my job, I went through a divorce, that relationship blew up, my parents got divorced, this thing happened, that thing happened. And not that we want those things to happen. None of us want to go back and go through that hard time, whatever it was. But that we recognize now from where we sit, it was during that time that I grew. It was that period of my life that led me to become the person I am now. And so it nearly always, and I'm leaving the nearly always there and what I actually mean is always, but I'm just leaving some space. Maybe there's somebody in the room that's figured out like, nope, I'm always growing and I'm always blue skies. And if you are, we hate you. Kidding. I just, it's not been my experience. That's not been the reality of almost anybody that I've ever talked to. And so I started thinking about what are the different kinds of crises that we have. And I think crisis is maybe a strong word, maybe challenge if you prefer that, or struggle or whatever. And so I started thinking about us as a church. The last year and a half of this church have been some of the most challenging, easily the most challenging in our 9.5 years. It's been harder and more frustrating and more heartbreaking to lead this church in the last year and a half than it was the first 7 combined, easily. but we're growing up out of it. It's made us make really hard decisions. It's made us make some lines and say, well, we can't be that. We're going to be this. And we're going to double down on this. And that's not easy, and we don't like it, but it's part of growing up. One of those crises that we just came through a couple months ago, I stood up here and told you all how we were about $30,000 behind on our giving for last year, for building the budget for this coming year. And so, like, for the first time in our church's history, we did a mini campaign, and I had to talk about money for 4 weeks straight. And that was super fun. Not at all, right? And we just had to be really honest about here's where we're at. And I was thinking through, like, how crisis forms us, and thinking through, like, so for the first 7 or 8 years of our church's history, when we built ministry budgets as a staff, we could build budgets, and we also knew if we overspent, it'd be fine, because we always, in the first 7 years, brought in more than we spent every year. It was always like that, which would be nice, right? Like, it's a nice, like, problem to have. Like, every year, like, oh, we brought in more than we planned. Except the last year or two, we haven't. But what's good is when, like, most of us know this experience, right? When you have limited resources, you know, you have to make choices. Do I do X or do I do Y? Because I sure can't do both. Do we go out to eat? Do we get cable? Do we give to this cause we care about? Do we buy a new couch? I cannot do them all. So what's most important? Right? We do that all the time. And it's the same thing is true as an organization. When we have to ask really hard questions about what's important to us, how do we spend our money? Okay, so yes, we would like to hire like 4 more staff positions. But what if we can't? What if we can only do 1? What if we do none? What does that look like? How do we do that? And what happens is when you face that kind of crisis, you grow up a little bit. You get a little bit stronger. Another crisis that I know, just all of us, is just personal crisis, right? I know from talking to you that if I just raise, let's just do this, generic. How many of you would say in the last year you faced some kind of personal crisis, whether it's work or a relationship or health or family, or you faced some kind of crisis in the last year? Yep. 80% of us, right? And if I said 2 years, probably all of us, right? If I just pull the perspective out a little bit and said a little bit longer. So not only are we a body that has organizational stuff going on, then I just start pulling us out, and this person, and these marriages are in trouble, and this person's losing their job, and this person's got health issues, and this thing, and that's just all around us all the time. And hopefully, we're all using those things as the mechanism by which we grow. Oh, man, I'm going through this thing and it's awful, but here's how I'm growing. And I don't want to be in it. I don't want to be sick. I don't want to be without a job. I don't want to, whatever. I don't want this. But because this is happening, boy, it's forcing me into my dealing with my stuff. It's forcing me into my own development, my own growth, my own becoming. I'm curious, of the 80% of you that had your hands up, how many of you would say in the last year in your own personal crisis, I've grown. I've grown, even if it's a little bit. Yeah, right? The third one I thought about is the cultural crisis of the week, right? Every week, Twitter brings us a new crisis of like, oh my gosh, this is the world we live in? And so for some of us, the crisis that we feel is about causes that we believe in. I was so proud two weeks ago. Remember that Sunday morning, if you were here, we scrapped the sermon and we had a conversation with Chris and Christina and I about race. And then there was a vigil that night down at Riverfront Park, Liberty Park, River Park. And now's the time to take a drink. It's just water. There was probably like 10 to 20% of the people that gathered for the vigil were us, right? Because there's something happening in our culture that we had to get involved with. Years and years ago, I heard Bill Hybels, the pastor of Willow Creek Community Church. He was talking about leadership, and he was talking about these kinds of things, and he used the analogy. It's stuck in my head forever. I kind of hate that it is. But he talked about, apparently, in the Popeye movie, which came out in 1983, I think, and I saw it in the theaters, and I thought it was okay. And then I tried to watch it a year ago, and it was awful. Robin Williams plays Popeye. Anybody remember this? And so, yeah, all of us of a certain age. And but there was a thing that he would say before he had popped the spinach, and he'd say, I can't stand it no more. And that idea of cultural crisis is that maybe some of us, we don't have personal crisis, and we don't have organizational feelings about the church at all, but there's cultural things that are causing crisis in us. There are things that we see happening in our world that we can't stand it no more. And I hear that. And there's growing collectives in our church of people saying, we just can't do that. Listen. You all sang this morning. Our only war is love. It's us for them. Do you realize how counter the narrative that is in our culture? That is not what we hear from our president or his Twitter feed. Our only war is love. It's us for them. And I don't mean to be political, except that maybe we have to be. Maybe as a church, responding to cultural crisis means we get involved in things that matter to us, even if they fly in the face of a party that we may like or not. And so that's part of the growing up, right? I think part of growing up is I'm finding that I... When I met Imam Mufti... All right, when I met Imam Mufti a couple years ago, just starting, and I'm already watching the clock... When I met Imam Mufti from the Islamic Foundation Center a couple years ago, we were talking specifically about acts of vandalism against mosques in America. And he said to me, and it was really challenging, I can't speak up on my own behalf. If I say that somebody sprayed graffiti on my mosque, nobody will care. But you, as a white, evangelical-ish pastor, I don't know. That's just complicated. He's like, but when you speak up for me, people will listen. And so a couple months later, when the Islamic school, when somebody spray painted their sign, you remember this? A couple months ago, somebody graffitied their sign early and immediately on Facebook, I saw some of my pastor, I posted it, and I know some of my pastor friends posted it. And by like 8 or 9 o'clock that morning, Christians in the community had raced to that sign and cleaned the sign. And then that school for the rest of the day was flooded with flowers and cookies and just, hey, we're with you in this. Because Christians cared about the cultural crisis. And it mattered to us and it changed our behavior. And I think as we're growing up as a church, we're finding that's more and more important to us to use our voice for good. And as much as it makes some of us really uncomfortable about politics, sometimes we just can't stay silent anymore, which is why a couple weeks ago with the Charlottesville thing, we killed our morning service and sat and had a conversation about race. Because we just can't let it pass by and say, oh, it's too controversial. Oh no, this is going to ruffle feathers. Oh no, people aren't going to like me if we talk about that thing. So part of this growing up, I think, has to do with leaning into those kinds of things. And then finally, maybe some of you are sitting there and you think, none of those are moving me. I don't really have organizational crisis, and I don't really have personal crisis, and I'm really not moved by the cultural stuff, then I've made up another word. I don't even know if that's a thing. Crisis identification. What I mean by this is that in the Bible, it talks about we laugh with those who laugh, we mourn with those who mourn. And if you aren't facing any of the others, and you're saying, I still want to grow, I believe there's still an invitation to you. Go join somebody in their crisis. Join somebody else in their suffering. Whether it's something in the culture or some personal crisis you know about, whatever it is, there's always the invitation to join another in their suffering, to give up my own pleasure, to give up my own time, to give up my own energy, to give up my own passion, to give up my own agenda and say to somebody else, I'm just going to sit with you in your thing and I'm going to try to feel what you feel and I'm going to try to journey in that with you to the best of my ability, even if it costs me something. And so I don't ever think we're in a space where there's just total like, oh, it's blue skies and I don't have any way to grow. And so I'm just going to kick back and I'm good. It's another tangent. I'm going to stop. Cut it off. You always have an invitation to join in somebody's crisis, to join in something out there, and in that we will be transformed. So that's the first one. Number two, maturing requires me to answer the question, who am I, not who I'm not. You notice that she says there, like, where you go, I'll go. Your gods will become my gods. Maturing requires her to answer that question, like, who am I? Ruth, at some point, stopped answering that question. I'm a young Moabite woman, married to, I don't know who she was married to, Mahlon or Chilion, whichever one. So as a church, when you're young, all right, so when you start out, we did a lot of, like, what kind of church is Imago Dei? And I would do a lot of, like, oh, we're not that, and we're not that, and we're not that, and we're not that. And that serves you for a time, right? You all did that too. Like, there was a time where you said, like, I'm not my parents, right? I'm not them, and I'm not that thing, I'm not that thing. But part of maturity means at some point you start saying, but this is what I am. This is who I am. And if at 43 years old, I'm still saying, I'm not that, and I'm not that, and not that, and I can't answer the question, then who are you? Then I haven't done my own work. And so part of the work of being and growing as a church is coming to a space where we can answer, who am I? Who are we? Who is it that we are? Bad grammar. So just a couple ideas that float around here. First of all, the five directives. If you're new to us, the five directives have remained almost unchanged in 9.5 years. They are still everything that we're about. They are still at the core of who we are. And if you think we're getting ready to change one of the directives, you're wrong. We're not. They still run deep in us. Just recently in a leadership team meeting, somebody was talking about, but, well, it seems like some visions are in conflict with this group and this group, things that. And I was like, no. When it comes to five directives, we're all united. We're all on the same page. The five directives drive us. And so this is the five directives. The one word answer, by the way, you can read them online. Real quickly, here's our five directives: everything, mission, process, community, Christian. The first one, I'm going to do them really quick. Everything is that everything is spiritual. Can I tell you one quick story? So a week ago, I had been backpacking for 4 days and 3 days. 3 days? Yeah, 3 days ago, a week ago, at this exact time, Justin and I were giving up on backpacking after 2.5 days. And we both have the mosquito bites, spider bites, chiggers, poison ivy, to prove it. We stood next to each other and rubbed each other's legs last night to scratch our chiggers. It was a really good moment. You should also go backpacking. It's wildly fun. Anyway, we got back to our campground back at this lake called Dutchman Lake, just south of Gordville, just north of Vienna. By the way, my mom is a Gore, and Karen is a Gore. It's our people. Gordville, Vienna, that's our people. And so that town was named after my ancestors, apparently. And so if you were tracking all the eclipse stuff, Carbondale was where the party was. NASA was set up in Gordville, and the University of Illinois rented out the whole Gordville High School and took over there. Gordville was the spot that had the longest period of eclipse, 2 minutes and 40 seconds. And so I was just like, what were we, like 8-10 miles south of Gordville, pretty close. And so we were up on a dam. That's church, a darn. And we were standing up there, and we had a great view all around us of the lake and all around, because we were kind of up on this hillside thing. And seriously, it's been a week, and I'm still trying to put into words what all happened there. And this is the best way I know to say it, and it connects to everything as spiritual, is that if you had, how many of you got to see totality? Wow, right? Words fail. Like, the word surreal feels like a one penny word. Like, it just feels so cheap for what that was. Anyway, so here's how it connects, is if you were watching totality, you would wear your glasses, right? And just like you all had the experience here, and you'd see the moon covering up more and more of the sun. And then there came this moment where it went dark in your glasses. You couldn't see anything. And so you take off your glasses, and what you see when you take off your glasses, this is the best picture I've seen. Jeff Earlson took this picture, and I was going to credit Jeff Earlson with the photo this morning. He was supposed to be playing piano, but he's not here. Neither is Holly. And So this is the picture Jeff Earlson took, and it's the best. It's the best thing I could find. And so, what happened? So I got to tell you, I don't know who these people are on this dam. We made friends with some weirdos, and like, let me tell you about one of the weirdos. She has a tattoo on her ankle, and I asked her like, so what's that tattoo on your ankle? And she's like, well, it's an alchemy sign for like Christ or something. And she said, but I'm not really into Christ. I'm much more into Satan these days. And I really don't even believe in, I don't even really believe in alchemy anymore. And I was like, cool. Whatever. That's just the tip of the iceberg of the interesting people we met. And so when the eclipse happened, when you take off your glasses, and it was this black orb up in the sky, and the sky was 360-degree horizon. What happened is 300 or 400 people standing on this dam all did the exact same thing at the same time. They all did this. And then erupted in cheers. And I tell it, and I get goosebumps again. Every time I tell it, I get goosebumps. Because then for 2 minutes and 40 seconds, 300 or 400 people stood on this dam, mostly just doing this, looking at the horizon and looking at the sun and full of wonder and awe. And if it were in this room, we would call it worship. And so all these people together, whatever they believe in about alchemy and Jesus and whatever they believe in, they were responding. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Every day they pour forth knowledge. That's from the Psalms. We were all united in this worship because something was happening, even if we didn't have words for it. And so when we talk about the idea that everything is spiritual, that's what we're after, is that everything, every moment has the potential for that kind of spirituality, that the Spirit is in us, moving among us, and there's always that potential. Mission has to do with the Breakfast Club and the garden and Honduras and all the ways that we serve other people. Process is just saying that everybody's on a journey. And so if you're new to this journey and you don't know nothing, don't know nothing. I've been in Gorville. If you don't know anything, that's okay. We're totally fine with that. And if you've been on this journey for a long time, we're okay with that too, right? And so we're just cool with wherever people are. Community is to say that I believe spiritual formation happens best in community. It happens best when I'm face-to-face with other people. And that sometimes happens. I have really close friends that we do this almost weekly, face to face. And I have a small group, and I have a wife where we're talking about this all the time. And I just think we need those groups and spaces where we're doing our spirituality out loud, talk it out. And then finally, that we're Christian. And this is where we double down on the idea of generous orthodoxy, that we make space for people who believe lots of different things. But we all come together over the Apostles' Creed. Other who am I's? Is that over the last 2 years, we've really doubled down on the idea that everyone belongs. You all sang, when we see our brother, we'll all be free. What's that? When we lay our hate down to wash their feet, we'll all be free. They have great song selection this morning, like a glove. I mean, I picked a couple of them, so you know. But still, I just told them to pick songs that are anthematic. And everyone, I was like, oh, that's who we are, right? That's who I want to be. And so we're really trying to figure this one out and to live into this more and more, that everyone belongs. Everyone has a seat here. And that is super challenging. When we did the week on race, I was saying, like, even white supremacists have a seat here somehow. And I don't even know what that means. And I think that'd be really hard. And there's... I might have to have them sit here with duct tape on their mouths. But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what we're singing. We're singing about laying down our hate, and we're making room for everyone, and it's super challenging. And so that's part of the who am I answer. We already sang this, and I keep referring to it, Us for Them. I just think that song, I was thinking this morning as you were singing, like, there's different eras of Imago where different songs were like the song that captured who we are. And I just feel like this song captures us in a way that what you said at the end, what you said, I don't even know if you caught it. You said at the very end, may this be so or something. And I think that's true. I think that song is so challenging to us. and yet is a rallying cry for that answering that who am I question. And then finally, the one that we don't give a lot of voice to here, but I wanted to share with you is the answer to who are we is that we're becoming the people's church. And I think that might have been the name of Jim Jones's church, and I apologize. I don't mean to impinge on his trademark of the people's church, but I just thought that. I wrote that in, and then later on, I was looking at slides, and I was rehearsing, and I was like, that might have been Jim Jones's church, but we're just going to ignore that and pretend it's not right now, because it stands in for an idea. And the idea is this. There's a couple ideas, but let me hit this one first. We did a survey early in the summer, and I asked you all two questions. I asked, and it was just open-ended. It was through Google Forms. You could answer any way you wanted. I asked, what brought you to Imago, and why do you stay? You remember this? Like 70 of you answered or something like that. A really good number of you answered. And some of you wrote us small novels that we're still working our way through and compiling data, which is great. And when we did that, we found what I think we already knew. We found that the draw of this church, what makes Imago Dei is Imago Dei Church. What makes us uniquely this church in Peoria is the one answer is this space, what we do here on Sunday mornings. Specifically, I think it's more about you all and that you all talk back, not like a talk back way, not like you go to your room, but like we're having a conversation here on Sunday mornings that draws people in. And then secondly, what we do at the breakfast, and not specifically maybe the breakfast, but everything that it stands for, but specifically the breakfast, that those two things are the things that make us, that really set us apart, which was cool to hear, and we kind of already knew that. But then what it came out to, which was really interesting, is that do you know how people get to this church? Here's what I would like to think. I would like to think that the reason people come to this church is because they meet me in the community or they listen to the podcast or they listen to us on Facebook Live and they're like, that Charlie Dean is so awesome. I'm going to go to that church. You know how many people answered that? Like two. Yes. I got two. You know the much more important answer? You know how people got here? You. They got here because of you. They got here because you asked them to come. It's not because we're doing something up here that's so amazing. People, this is a shocking revelation. People come to church because other people ask them. And there's been this weird dynamic over the years. I'll pick on Laura. I remember when you first came, you're like, is this church a secret or something? Like, you asked me after coming for a couple weeks, like, is it okay to talk about this church in other places? And as if like we have somebody at the door like, and the password is. Oh, like that's a game show. But still, it'd be fun. And so we struggled with this over the years. And yet realizing that the most powerful people in this church are the people, not the pastor, when it comes to inviting new people into church. So here's what's really fun. This is good times here. So Dustin, a couple months ago, probably starting in January, did you start on this? Yeah, let's say January. Let's pretend. So about January, Dustin started working with a team to say, we don't have something really great to put in people's hands when they first come to our church. And so we usually give them the annual report, which is just weird. And then the current annual report out there is 2 years old, and that's weird. And so various levels of weird. And so we, Dustin started the initiative to create something that when people come here for the first time, we can put in their hands and say, here you go. Here, this just gives us a little taste and feel of who we are. And then Laura Baumgartner, where's Laura? I'm looking in her section. She's not here this morning. Oh, man. You want to give somebody props and they're not here. All right, well, if you see Laura, she then designed this little thing. And so here's what we're going to do this morning. Go. Yes, go for it. Corey, can you help him? So here's what we're going to do this morning. These are going to become, they're just going to start sitting out on Sunday mornings. They're going to be sitting out on the table out front. They're going to be sitting on the booth. And then we're going to put one of these in your hand this morning. And here's what we're asking you to do. here's what happens in my life at least. And I know because as soon as I say I'm pastor, it happens. But I know that in your life, this happens too. That you're at a baseball game, you have somebody to your house, and somewhere along the way, somebody starts a conversation about, where do you go to church? Well, I go to church here. And they ask about your church. And then what we often do, because we're not sure if it's a secret or not, like I go to Imago Dei Church, and they say, what kind of church is that? And you're like, it's quirky and weird. And which is the way I answer all the time. It's a little strange. I'm a bit much for some people I know. And then it just kind of dies there. So we're putting one of these in your hand, and here's what we're empowering you to do. The next time you have that conversation with somebody and they say, hey, tell me about Imago Dei Church, like what's it about? And you're like, besides quirky and weird, I've got nothing. You just hand them one of these. Just give them one. And we made, there is a huge box up here of them, all right? Yeah, you can get more. There's a box of them, and if we run out, we'll buy more. And if you want to take more, you just give it away, and then you come in the next week and grab some more and take them home. You can leave it on the back of your toilet. You can leave it on your coffee table, wherever you leave reading materials for people at your house. Oh, come on. If you don't have that, you know people are on their phone. So we're just going to put that in your hand and say, here's your chance. I don't really care about us growing into a really big church, but I also know that there's people in your life. I mean, Laura was kind of mad at me when we had this conversation a couple years ago, that it was such a secret that she hadn't found us for a couple years, and I don't want any more Lauras. I don't want people angry at me because, I mean, I want, no. I didn't mean it in that way. Listen, here's the deal. There are a lot of Lauras in our community. There are a lot of people like Laura who are looking for exactly this kind of church. Oh, time. I did a wedding yesterday, and I love doing weddings, and they're super fun, and really expose me to a crowd often that doesn't go to church at all. And so, you know, maybe you haven't seen me do a wedding ceremony. It's kind of like this. It's a little bit chaotic and wild, wild west of weddings. And sometimes I just say ridiculous things and think, oh my gosh, this was a wedding and I'm just being stupid. And so every time I do a wedding, we laugh a lot. And the couple I was marrying yesterday, they just laugh a lot anyway. So we had a lot of fun. And I can't tell you how many people came up to me afterwards and say something like, I've never been to a wedding ceremony like this. And I say, thanks, I think. And I say to them, I say, because I've worked this out over many, many weddings, I say to them something like, you know, the thing is that I think weddings should be filled with joy. I mean, crazy idea. A wedding ought to be joyful, and it ought to be fun, and we ought to laugh, and maybe we ought to cry too, and we ought to say really hard stuff, and then we ought to laugh again, and then we should celebrate. And it's amazing the response people get. And sometimes, I don't do this everywhere I go. Sometimes I just want to say, you know what? We do this every Sunday morning. We laugh, and we get really serious, and we cry sometimes, and we just kind of journey through life together. Because if you can't laugh, and you can't enjoy it, and you can't have serious talks, like, what's the point, right? At least for me. I want it all. I want all those things. And so, anyway, this is your tool. It's for you, and you ought to thank Dustin for putting it together, because it's awesome. And then a corollary to that is that won't fit in your wallet. And so years ago, we made up blank business cards for some of you that we haven't put out in a long time. There's a box of these sitting on the welcome booth if you just want to throw a business card or two in your wallet. They're just blank. They have the church address and website, but nobody's name on it. So you can grab those if you want to. We'll keep those out for a while again. Last point. The last way of what it means to grow up is as I mature, my relationships with people change. And we see this in the story where Ruth's, this statement is just so beautiful. Your people will become my people. What happens in time is that relationships change. This year, so two things. Is that one, we're starting to work on this 10th anniversary stuff, right? And as part of the 10th anniversary stuff, I was sending out an invite to some people to be part of a brainstorming team, and then we'll recruit more teams. And I was making a list of the people who started the church and who still left. And it just makes me sad. Almost 10 years later, more than half of them are gone. Some of them moved away, and others left. And it's been the most painful part of being a pastor is when people leave. And I know that's true for all of us. We all have seasons where that becomes the reality in our lives, and that's what we have to do. And it's just still painful. And the other thing that happened this year is that in February, the final two remaining members of the original leadership team left our leadership team. And so Eric Potter left to go pastor another church. and Kevin, after 9 years, stepped down from leading the resource team. And so part of maturing, part of growing up is your relationship to things changes, right? And so it's the hard part of parenting, right? Like my boys aren't really ever going to crawl up in my lap again and cuddle like they did when they were 3 and 4. If they did, it'd just be especially you. That would be weird. Maybe Maddox can get away with it a little bit, but I'm not. Don't know that I'm going to cuddle with you, bro. And there's days Jennifer and I talk about I'd love to have one day back of 3-year-olds. Just one day. Which is, I think that's what's going to be so much fun about grandparenting, is you get to kind of redo it again. Yeah, yeah. You get to kind of redo it, don't you? But on your terms. That's the best part. And so part of this growing up as a church is it's changing the nature of all kinds of things. Here's the analogy, is that here's what I think it requires. When we started the church, if you think of the church as a car, what kind of car would we be? An old Volkswagen bus, right? That's the kind of, I remember when I was at Northwoods and we did this with the marketing firm, like we were a Honda Odyssey. Not this church. We are not the Honda Odyssey of churches. With panels of all different colors, yeah. Yeah. Oh, we could totally go down this Partridge Family. Yes. It's the same family, all answering the same question. All right, And so, you know, early in the days of a church plant, what most often happens in the early days of the church plant is a charismatic, young-ish leader who has two hands on the wheel. And so everything, like, my way, has to be my way. I have the vision. I'm the one that sees it. We're going to go that way. And that serves you pretty well for a while. And we had a good leadership team that I was working with, but you know, initially it was by myself, and then we hired David, and then over time added more and more staff. But 9.5 years in, you have to continue to change your relationship to the team, right? To the organization if we're going to mature. And we could always stay an infant church plant where I have to have my hands on the wheel all the time, but I don't think that's how you get to maturity. And so we've been having conversations in our leadership team about what does it look like for me to take my hands off the wheel and to allow others to have the wheel. So literally, you need to hear how this looks. Literally, this talk, most years, this talk I create and then I just deliver. And some years I've given the leadership team a heads up, like here's what we're doing. Literally, what I'm saying here today, some of it I'm just being a mirror. Is that we have a leadership team who more and more, they're leading the church and I'm serving them. And that's the relationship we have. And there probably is gonna come a reality soon where we're probably gonna do a reorg in terms of how we do our church polity, which nobody cares about. But to make that more official, because we have really, really capable leaders who can lead this church really, really well. And it just means that my role is just different. But I'm convinced, as we've journeyed through some of the crisis stuff, I'm convinced that me leading alone isn't the thing that's best for the church. That we're better with a stronger and increasingly stronger leadership team. Does that all make sense? It's the people's church. It's not Charlie's church. It was never supposed to be Charlie's church. And so we're empowering people to lead this church. So I want to recognize some people because you need to see their faces. So first of all, I wanted to say, I'm going to start with Emily and Brian and Chris. So the three of you stand up. These three people have become my closest confidants as we lead, and we talk a lot. They put in hours none of you will ever know to help lead this church. I would ask for an estimate, but I'd be embarrassed to know how many hours you three of you have spent this summer. And I just work really closely with them. And I've told people outside of our church, like I have so much trust in these three people to lead our church well. And so we're going to applaud for all the leaders in just a minute. And so then around them is our leadership team. So will the rest of the leadership team stand up? And so I want you to see the rest of the leadership team, Eric and Laura and Steve over there. And then along with our leadership team is the staff. And so Dustin and Christina are on the front row. Go ahead and stand up. We were having a staff. Some of you are new enough that you don't even know our staff, and that's okay. Christina's on staff. Some of you don't know that. She's half-time. Dustin's full-time. And then Ashby's been in a season of making babies. And we see Ashby all the time, but Sunday mornings are rough for the Pattersons, understandably. And so stand up. Ashby is our assistant in the office. And if you don't know Ashby, you should. And then underneath those teams, we have our resource team and our formation team and the ministry team. And so will all of you stand up? And so they do the things that I just said. They lead the formation of the church. The formation team works with me and sermons and things like that and leading formationally. Ministry team works on all the ministries, and the resource team takes care of the building and that. And then I know there's a Genesis team and a Breakfast Club team. Is there more people that can stand up out of that? And any teams I'm missing? Is there a greeting team? 15 teams. These are the biggest ones. And so these are the people that lead the church. And there's others I know that I'm missing out on, but would you just recognize these people for the hours and hours and hours they put in? You should hear how much I love and trust them. And if my opinion matters to you at all, you should understand what I'm saying. They lead us well. I don't know what the challenges are ahead. I don't know what organizational or personal crises are coming. I can guess at some, but you know, there's stuff coming down the road. We didn't know a year ago that we were going to be in a budget. Well, we may have had hints. We maybe a little bit saw it coming, and we're hoping. And so sometimes you see stuff, sometimes you don't. And I want you all to hear that we have really capable leaders. And one of my favorite exercises right now is, as a leadership team, we're pretty intentional about scanning the church for other leaders. And so we literally are having conversations all the time about who are the next leaders? Who are the next ones? Who are the people that we need to be inviting into leadership? And that's a really fun conversation. And I know just the other night we identified a couple names of, hey, let's ask this person to move into some more leadership roles because we just need more voices, because this is not Charlie's church, it's the people's church. Open the doors and see all the people. Why? Can I tell you one other thing about backpacking? Is when you have a crazy mind like yours, crazy things happen in your head when you have hours and hours of walking in silence. We are the world for a couple days. Just because. Silently. Yes, silently. I'm going to wrap up. Here's where I want to end with vision for this year is I think that is the vision for us as a church. We're growing up. And all of those things are part of growing up. And we're finding our voice and we're finding all those things. And I wanted to end by just saying I love you. I really, 2 weeks ago down at the riverfront, it was just one of those moments of like, oh, I love this church. And the week where we did the racial thing, when we talked about race here in church, I just walked away again enamored with you all. Like, that was so beautiful, and the way people engage in those kinds of conversations. And I'm not saying this to brag, but I do want you to know there are very, very, very few churches in this whole country that could just say on a Sunday morning, let's pass the mic around and let's talk. Very, very few. And I'm just really proud to be identified with you all. I believe more, probably more than I ever have, that this church matters in Peoria. That this church, there's a lot of churches that are like each other, that, like, I've been a part of those. Like, if this church closes down, there's like 10 more like it, right? And this one, we just have such a unique voice and a unique role to play in our city, both in terms of how we serve and what we think and how we try to be in the world. And I'm really proud to be on this journey with you all. We can say five directives and all that, but at the very top of it all is that we're a church because we all come here and we come to the table. That no matter who we are and how we are and what our last week experience has been or how messed up we feel or if we think we've got our theology right or wrong or frankly, even if we go here or don't go here or we used to go here, I believe that at the table, none of that matters. That at the table we all come and it's the I love the old phrase, the ground is level at the table. And I love that we serve it down on the ground and we all stand on the ground together because that's what it is. And so I'm going to pray and then we'll take communion together. Let's pray. Dear God, I just am very, very thankful that I get to be a part of this place. And I know many of us are. And so help us to keep growing up, to not be satisfied with what we've done or what the past was or the things that we accomplished back then or how we grew back then, but help us to keep leaning forward, to keep asking what's next, and to keep growing up. And help us, growing up sometimes requires hard decisions. Help us to make good, hard decisions and help us to know the next right things to do. In your name I pray. Amen.